Hi, Jim.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Here almost.
Almost. In fact, you know, before I called you, I was I wanted to see if there's anything big has changed in your life, so I Googled you, and I got your Wikipedia entry, and it says he appears frequently on Blogging Heads TV. Well, not frequently enough, Jim Pinkerton. We're going to have to either edit that entry or you're going to have to change a few things.
We can do this the easy way or the hard way. I got it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you've seen me do things the hard way. In fact, you might say all my life. Never mind. So this is kind of a year-end retrospective, prospective, contemplative kind of thing.
Okay.
And normally, at some point in a conversation with you, you go into apocalyptic mode.
Mm.
Should we just start with that?
Should we start? Right. Well, I don't know. Gee, that's a hard question.
I'll move on to the next one then. Okay.
Okay. How about the Redskins?
Now, yeah. On Fox News, you're a Fox News contributor, I should say, and they don't like throw curveballs like that at you, right? That only happens on Blogging Heads.
They usually. Look, I think many things are going well and many things are going badly. I think probably the biggest news of the year in terms of what we'll remember is the rise of an assertive China.
An assertive China.
Right. If you think about all the American wars that got started with naval incidents, from the War of 1812 mm-hmm. to the Spanish-American War to World War One, from an American point of view, being Lusitania, from World War II, of course, Pearl Harbor, and, of course, Vietnam, the Tonkin Gulf incident, the news that an American and Chinese ship nearly collided on December 5th is not small. The Chinese are what's known as a revisionist power, and they fully intend to overcome the deficit they fell into over the last 500 years. I don't blame them for feeling that way, but I think it's full of implications for Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and frankly, the United States.
Possibly apocalyptic ones, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is how wars begin, mm-hmm. and I don't think that we're mentally and psychologically, I don't think we're ready for it. And I think actually, because, the other thing I always bring up in every Blogging Heads with you is not only apocalypticism, but also the great book Non-Zero. So I will say in defiance of that book, which told us that Bill Clinton would bring in Nirvana.
Oh, give me a break. It was by the time it was anyway.
So, I mean, I don't actually think the world is moving toward cooperation and harmony and peace and understanding in the age of Aquarius or anything. I think parts are going really well, and I think there's some really scary stuff, which probably in the same way that, the various incidents like the Algeciras incident in, I think, Morocco in 1911 between Germany and France or whoever it was. But it was one of those incidents that people said, look back at the time, seemed like, well, it's just a little imperial incident on the periphery somewhere. But in fact, it turned out to be a big deal as the origins of World War One.
Okay, well, laudably, I will only spend a little bit of time correcting your characterization of my book, Non-Zero. It does not say the world is inevitably moving towards Nirvana. It says there is the very real chance of us screwing it up as we approach the global level of social organization.
Therefore, the title is misleading. Is that what you're saying?
No. We are more and more playing non-zero-sum games, but non-zero-sum games can be played to a lose-lose outcome.
Okay.
It's
non-zero unless it's zero.
No. It's still non-zero if it's lose-lose. That is a lose-lose outcome to a non-zero-sum game. The sum does not equal zero. A win-win outcome. The sum does not equal zero. That's why it's a non-zero-sum game.
So I guess the title then, non-zero, completely summed up all the nuances that you wanted to get across.
Titles do that, don't they?
Okay. I feel like I checked that box. We're good.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, I share some of your concern about the possibility of some little dispute over some little island getting big. But first of all, let me be clear. I mean, you're not saying that China's behaving in an especially unusual way. It's a rising power, as the United States was once. And you may notice that their legacies of the U.S.'s intervention much farther away from American shores and much closer to China, by the way, than any of the things we're talking about in China, right? I mean, China's talking about disputed territory very close to it. There's the Taiwan issue, and there's Tibet. Let me put it this way. You don't think of China as a kind of endlessly expansionist power, right? You see it as carving out the kind of sphere of influence that rising powers try to carve out.
I think they're probably endlessly expansionist. I think that
endlessly they would attack America if they could.
The same way we were endlessly expansionist, or the same way that Great Britain was endlessly expansionist, mm-hmm. or the same way that Rome was. You endlessly, as you rise in power and wealth, you expand until somebody stops you. And that's sort of the way of the world. I mean, look, what we haven't had before, the Chinese have been a leading civilization for as long as there's been civilizations, right? They're the leading inventing country for most of human history, or the civilization. What they lacked was a sense of empowering their own middle class, such as, I mean, we're talking peasants now, peasants and workers. And so and not just empowering for the sake of being politically nice, but empowering in the sense of mass production and economics of scale. So they invented gunpowder and the compass and paper and printing and all these things, and it never really occurred to the Confucian aristocrat bureaucrats running the place that there's any real need to share that with the masses or in any way mass produce them. So they had all this stuff, and the emperor and his little concubines and minions would sit there and admire this little skyrocket going off. It took the Europeans who were lagging behind them, but were nonetheless not stupid, to, hey, wait a second, we could make a cannon out of this. We could make, you know, weapons out of this. And of course, beginning in the 16th century, they overwhelmed China. Only in the last few decades have the Chinese really began to think, well, not only are we smart, but we're also going to mass produce this stuff. I mean, Chairman Mao was sort of a hybrid figure. On the one hand, he was, you know, was perfectly able and anxious to lord it over the peasants, just with his own Chinese bureaucracy, you know, just as the Confucians had been doing for the thousands of years before that. But he did build an A-bomb. He wasn't dumb. He did have a sense of, you know, world power, and knew that nuclear weapons were part of it. In the last couple decades, or three decades or so, the Chinese said, not only are we going to be smart, but we're also going to be mass producers. And that's something the world just hasn't seen ever.
You know, I'm not so sure they would have minded being mass producers before. What happened was they finally adopted a kind of variant of capitalism. They adopted a much more market-oriented economy, so they started succeeding at mass producing a lot of, you know, the reforms of Deng Xiaoping. I think to a large extent, the reason they are increasingly seen as a rival and have the material resources to be seen that way is because they have adopted a certain amount of what you could call the American way, certainly in the economics. It's a more statist capitalism for the time being. Even that is changing. But anyway,
it's the industrial way. What they adopted was the mass. Look, the emperor in 1080 or, you know, 1580, whoever he was not thinking about industrial development and the way, say, Francis Bacon was in Europe, the way Colbert was in France, and this is Jean-Baptiste Colbert in the 17th century, or Henry Clay in the 19th century. They weren't thinking that way, and that was why they were defeated. Now they are thinking that way, and I really, again, I just don't. I think we've got a, you know, few hundred, 2,000 years ahead of us, where a really, really smart civilization with really, really big ambitions and a strong sense of industrial wherewithal, including not just, you know, making toys, but, you know, leading the world on supercomputers and sorts of other kinds of technologies. I think we're in for a hell of a ride.
I think the hope lies in the fact that I don't think China wants anything to spoil its economic progress, first of all. In fact, you know, the government is very nervous because it wants to remain a one-party system, and it sees that the citizenry more and more kind of has the power to protest, which it actually does a lot of. And so the government is very concerned with maintaining economic growth, bringing more and more people into the middle class. And I don't think it wants to really disrupt that. I've seen no signs that China like wants an actual war. It currently has a premier who's kind of playing the nationalist card with respect to these islands. And by the way, I gather that the question over who the islands rightfully belong to is actually kind of complicated. They're not inventing the controversy. But But my sense is that China fundamentally wants stability.
So, how do you know that?
That's just the way they behave.
Well, except it's not.
Jim, who goes around? Here's a multiple choice question. Who goes around invading countries, America or China?
I said, Bob, that's my point. A country that gets rich and powerful, it climbs its Maslowian hierarchy. Well beyond food, shelter, and prosperity, into self-actualization. So yes, we have self-actualized our way to the point where we, the Americans, say, "Oh yes, we have to worry about human rights in Afghanistan and Iraq and Tibet and everywhere else, and the rainforest and CO2 level in 100 years." We have achieved infinite ambitions as a nation based on prosperity, and now we're going to wake up and discover that another country has equally infinite ambitions based on prosperity. I guarantee that 20 years from now, if China continues at anywhere near the growth rate they are, there's going to be some hate crime against a Chinese American, and the Chinese government's going to call up the ambassador and say, "Look, what are you going to do about this? You know, some Chinese American got hurt or killed or wounded or something somewhere." I just think there's every reason of human nature to assume that they will have all the ambitions that we have.
And if
you go to China and you turn on the TV, all you see is movies about the Chinese Japanese war of the 30s and 40s. And for the reasons you said, they've got a one party system that's struggling for legitimacy. The best guarantor of legitimacy for a government is foreign crisis, including foreign wars. Nobody needs the Chinese communists to manage the economy. We agree on that. Well, they can do that with a kind of state capitalism cartel model. What you do need a government for is to lead us to victory against the enemy.
Although tension is enough for, you know, I mean, playing the nationalist card is indeed valuable politically. And unfortunately, we have a leader in both Japan and China right now who doesn't mind doing that. But the tension is enough. You don't need the actual war. Right?
So look, the Kaiser and Clemenceau, Poincaré and the Tsar and the Emperor Ferdinand or whoever they were in World War I, they felt the same way. They didn't want a war. They didn't want a general war. They wanted to win the point against Serbia over the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand. The South didn't want a war against the Union. It just wanted to secede quietly.
Well, I agree with what I think you're saying, is that war is most likely to come from what, you know, in effect is almost a miscalculation. Not China's aspiration to invade major countries. So, but anyway, what would you do? What would you advise? Is there anything you would advise American policymakers to do?
Sure. Prepare.
Yeah, prepare. Build weapons.
Look, I think we have two choices. One is we either have to fundamentally and profoundly rethink the nature of our commitment to, say, Taiwan, mm-hmm. And the Senkaku Islands, and quite possibly South Korea and Japan. Either we rethink that, or we better prepare in a big, and I do mean big way.
Well, I think Taiwan's very different from Japan and South Korea. China's not going to invade Japan or South Korea. The way they would get into a war is some dispute over, you know, miscalculation in this island dispute. Whereas Taiwan, they want to be theirs. That's an important part of their national self-conception.
But what if as a compromise, we agree on Taiwan? What if the Chinese say one day, look, we think we should have a naval base in Japan? That would certainly say the Americans have one. Why shouldn't we have one too?
And Japan says no. You think China's going to invade to get it? Come on.
And then the Chinese say, you know, gosh, it would be a shame if your entire electrical infrastructure, internet grid went out because we have.
I think we do disagree about bad things could happen. That's not going to happen.
Okay, we'll
revisit. We'll see.
Who knows what will happen when? But in 10 years, I guarantee, if we continue to perfect our skills at fighting global warming and combating homophobia and patriarchy, and the Chinese continue to perfect their skills at stealing all our technology, I think this conversation will seem a lot more relevant.
Okay, we face a problem here, Jim, which is, and I hadn't thought this through, I admit, when I asked you to go apocalyptic on us. If we do the apocalypse at the beginning of our discussion, the rest is kind of an anticlimax, right? I mean, so aren't there other...
That's what editing's for.
Aren't there other apocalypses you can point to? The Middle East ain't looking too stable. I'll tell you, here we disagree. I think the Middle East is a more likely tinderbox. In fact, it's already gotten beyond the tinderbox stage, I would say, but a more likely source of trouble than China.
Why?
I
don't agree. Why?
You don't agree?
No.
Where do I begin?
Okay.
Well, first of all, the Syrian conflict is going international. We had a former American ambassador, Lebanese ambassador, killed, I think, you know, within the last week, by a bomb in Lebanon. That's kind of getting out of control. I mean, the hopeful sign, and of course, Israel-Palestine remains unresolved, and John Kerry is a fool to think he's going to change that. But you do have this larger Sunni Shia thing starting to emerge, right? This larger Sunni Shia tension and tearing apart various societies, showing the signs of that: Lebanon, Iraq, not just Syria. The Iran thing is hopeful, but there you have what I would call extremists in both the U.S. and Iran trying to derail the deal. You're probably skeptical about the value of the deal to begin with. But I think if we played our cards right, we could actually, that could be a great thing, bringing Iran back into the community of nations, which I think in the long run could be a product of this deal. So that's good. But again, that there are people so determined to derail that in both the U.S. and Iran that I'm not.
I don't have any doubt in myself that Iran will have nuclear weapons in 10 years.
Hmm.
Deal or no deal. I think the Middle East is less of a concern to me for one big reason. We're not there in a big way. Well, not the way we used to be in Iraq, that's for sure. We're tuning out of Afghanistan.
But we're there just in the very sense that we're in Asia, which is we have commitments to Israel and Saudi Arabia, just as we have commitments to Japan and South Korea.
I don't think that our commitment to Saudi Arabia is too meaningful.
Well, okay, Israel.
Israel is meaningful, and I think the Israelis can defend themselves. I think that the Sunni Shia war can go on all around the Middle East, and except for the occasional fog of poison gas or something, I don't think the Israelis have much to lose from that.
I would say
I think they're better off.
I do think the Israelis can
fight each other, but the Israelis are better off.
I do think Israel can withstand a whole lot and spends more time concerned about its survival than is really in order, but. On Iran, I think if there is a deal at the end of this 6 months, I don't think they'll have nuclear weapons in 10 years. On the other hand, if you think they will, which is not impossible, and yet you're not concerned, I take it one thing you're saying is that nuclear weapons in the hands of Iran needn't be destabilizing. There I agree.
I would put it another way. It is destabilizing. It's just inevitable. It's not that hard.
But if it's destabilizing, you should be more concerned than you sound. I don't think it fundamentally is.
I'm concerned about things that will get the United States into World War III. Those I'm concerned about.
I'm not concerned about
the U.S. intervening in South Sudan because I don't think that'll lead to anything.
Okay, but in other words, you don't think, as Bibi Netanyahu claims, that if Iran had nuclear weapons, they would use them on Israel.
No.
Well, we agree.
Right. And however, on the abundance of caution principle, I do think that both the U.S. and Israel, and for that matter, South Korea and Japan and, you know, whoever else, need to make a major investment in missile defense, because even though I don't think it'll happen, I can't rule out the possibility. What I can rule out is the idea that there's anything that the U.S. or Israel can do to stop Iran from ultimately getting a nuclear weapon.
I think if we didn't face the domestic constraints, as they say, when they're referring to AIPAC and allied groups, on our policymaking, I think we would get the deal done with Iran in 6 months, and I don't think they'd wind up with a nuclear weapon.
I don't think they'd keep it.
Oh, I think they would. The deal that they envision and that their president envisions and we envision involves just totally unprecedented monitoring. It's not like it would be easy.
They're a smart and clever people, and just because they sign some deal with some dope like John Kerry doesn't mean they're going to keep it.
Okay, we'll see.
I mean, I don't think, you know, look, again, what you and I share is a common kind of realist worldview, and as I mentioned with China, the one smart sort of economic strategic thing that Chairman Mao did was get an A-bomb. China has been attack-proof since 1964, okay? I mean, countries that have A-bombs go... Are attack proof. Yeah. The Europeans know that, they're not going to get derailed because the stupid P5 tells them not to do it.
Well, no, but No, but I agree with what you're saying, that what you're implying, which is that if Iran does go for a nuclear weapon, it will be partly out of a belief that that is what it takes to remain secure. And that is a perception that could be altered by our behavior toward Iran. They really believe that America would like to invade them, and that's part of the motivation for building a nuclear.
If they look at the Iranians, if America suddenly goes peacenik, and the Iranians still have to deal with the Arabs and the Saudis and the Pakistanis and everybody. I mean, it's just so obvious to a country. This is the ticket that takes you into just like Pakistan. Yeah. Why are we still giving a billion or so a year to Pakistan? It's for one reason.
It gets you a kind of respect to have a nuclear weapon. There's no doubt about it.
So the Pakistanis don't do what they probably are going to wind up doing, which is selling a bomb to your choice, Iran or Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or whoever, just because that's kind of just what there's no, in the history of the universe, there's no weapon that somebody invented that didn't get used. And once one country gets it, the other countries want it.
Okay. So so your view of the Middle East is tragic, but not apocalyptic. Your view of China is apocalyptic.
Tragic, but actually in a way, from an American point of view, and also from an Israeli point of view, it's not that bad when your enemies are fighting each other.
No, it's not. I think Israel's threats arise from another front, which is not solving the Palestinian problem. But I think you disagree. But I think you think that can go on forever without.
I think the Palestinian problem is being solved in an unsatisfactory way right before our eyes.
In what sense?
Just not planning on giving an inch.
Yeah, well, that's not a solution, though. I mean, the grievances will remain.
Grievances will remain, but that's all right. I think eventually any Palestinian who feels sufficiently aggrieved will leave.
Well, that may be a hope in some quarters in Israel, that you'll have a kind of a slow motion ethnic cleansing. I mean, there are Israeli politicians who talk that way, but
I think it's going to take a long time. I think they have the best handle on the situation.
But meanwhile, Israel's starting to facing a little ramping up of the international pressure on this front. They had the recent academic, pseudo boycott by the American Studies Association or whatever. I mean, in other words, it's not a boycott with teeth, but that kind of thing scares them. It gets their attention, and you could have more of that.
I don't think it really does scare them. I think it annoys them. It's irksome, that's for sure. But look, if you give me a choice, the boycott by the American Studies Association and throw in another 5 or 10, liberal arts academic groups, including in the European Union, or 3 or 4 more iterations of Moore's Law, I'll take the latter, and so would the Israelis.
Okay. Yeah, no, I don't think that's going to do it. I think their genuine fear is that it grows into something like South Africa faced. It gets beyond the token. And that's why they want to head it off now. That's why you get the fierce resistance to this kind of thing.
And that's why I think that's why the problem that South Africa had was that it was, 75% black, and Israel doesn't have that problem.
No, but it seems reluctant to give the vote. It's got enough Palestinians in the West Bank that it doesn't want to see them voting, much less in Gaza. Enough levity, Jim. How do you feel about the legalization of marijuana? It's going to happen January 1st in Colorado, I think.
Yeah,
you planning a little vacation there for Boulder, a little hiking in Boulder, perhaps?
I'm not against legalization, but I'm not a pot smoker, and so I'm sort of don't really have a dog in that fight. I suspect that it will not work out as well for the legalization side as they hope, in terms of I think there will be problems. You will see a lot of minors puffing away. You will discover that smoking marijuana causes lung cancer just as smoking tobacco causes lung cancer. But sometimes you just have to work your way through a problem.
So we have zero real concern about that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not for pot, smoking pot, but I'm also not for throwing people in jail for doing it.
What about cocaine?
I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm probably. What do you think?
I ask the questions, buddy. You sit there and squirm uncomfortably. That's the division of labor here. Okay? I thought we made that clear. But cocaine's a tough one. I actually think I am. I would not rush to legalize cocaine. I think it's in a different category from marijuana. I think all drugs are addictive, basically, in some meaningful sense, in the sense of being habit-forming in a way that can be hard for some people to break. Marijuana, for certain kinds of people, it does turn them into slackers and sap their ambition. And as a parent, I was relieved to see my kids get through their teens without that happening. It had been, you know, a concern, not because of the way they behave, but just since they were very young. I thought, well, I hope they don't, like, you know, start smoking dope every day in high school. Because I think that can put you on in a certain path. That said, I agree with you. You can't be throwing people in jail for this. Cocaine, you know, it's funny. In principle, the same. It feels crazy to throw people in jail for whatever they do to their own lives, you know. But it's also true that cocaine is a more insidious drug. So I don't know. It's your turn. What do you think?
The one thing I'll say in the long run, you know, I think piety and hedonism. And since I put my credentials down as somebody who worries about America being defeated in a war, I mean, really defeated, as in abandoning your cities because they're in flames. And meanwhile, the other guy's tanks are going through your capital. It would be bad strategy, bad national destiny for America to have a country full of potheads when the guy comes to.
So your concern, just to fully flesh out the apocalyptic vision, is the Chinese tanks show up at the steps of the White House and everyone in D.C. is like stoned and watching the Three Stooges on reruns on TV.
And eating brownie. Yeah. let me be clear. I don't really blame the Chinese for having the exact same ambitions that we do. Okay, I think that's perfectly understandable. It's the waning and waxing of empires, and 100 things could go wrong with China, just like 100 things could go wrong with America. I think the modern warfare will consist of cyber hacking and blinding satellites and, you know, a few cruise missiles here and there. And when I read, for example, on ZDNet 3 years ago that the Chinese have, quote, pervasive access to 80% of the communications equipment in the world, I think the next war could be kind of pathetically push button, where we suddenly wake up one day and realize that we can't turn on our internet. And at that point, a modern country can't fight, and a modern economy can't function. I don't think you need to invade. I do think, however, and again, back to this ship collision or near collision in the Pacific a few weeks ago, that plus what's going on with North Korea and the Senkaku reminds us that even in this cyber virtual digital age, the imperatives of what great powers do, which is to say they fight over principles and territories and air defense zones and so on, that never changes. If we were smart, we'd be saying, look, it's great that we have all this digital Google, you know, that stuff. Now let's make sure that it's weaponizable, so that if we needed it in a confrontation, not because we enjoy fighting. I'm basically a dove, as I think you are, Bob. I'm just simply a heavily armed dove because you can't be a dove in a world where other people are interested in military solutions.
Can be. I just think you think you'll be a dead dove.
You'll be a dead dove. Yeah. And so the pot smoking thing, again, I can't, as with you, I agree. The cocaine is a different category. I can't be against it. I just think we're going to ultimately need a plan of suasion, not criminality, but criminalization, but suasion that says, look, you really owe it to yourself and your family and your country to keep your marbles together and not just become a pot. Because we both have seen it, just being products of the baby boomer products of the 50s. I do know a lot of kids I went to high school with who really never recovered from being potheads. Yeah. And they're now fixing bicycles in their middle age.
Which is, you know, there are worse lives. But I agree that it can alter your path in life fundamentally. And it could be a pretty seductive drug. Otherwise, I mean, I at the same time, I'm not saying on balance it does more damage than alcohol. I suspect it does worse. It certainly gets fewer people killed on the highways, but and fewer spouses beaten.
All those things, again, yeah, that's back to suasion. We put a lot of effort in this country. You know, prohibition is kind of laughable. However, fights against drunk driving and fights for temperance and fights for self-discipline and fights for, you know, coffee as opposed to alcohol. I mean, those are all worth doing, and it's a lot more work if you have to spend your time going sort of person to person saying, look, you know, all things in moderation. I think Washington State and Colorado, those are the two places I think that have legalized pot just as by referendum, are both going to sort of realize 5 years from now that this problem they have is a lot more complicated than they realize.
Well, when they for one thing, they're going to become, because the other states haven't legalized it, they're going to become a slacker magnet, man. I mean, they really are. And then they're going to, and that's going to be a backlash, believe me. But
end up on unemployment and disability because they can just live in a blanket on the sidewalk across the street from the dispensary. Right.
Now, the good news, the redeeming thing here, Jim, as I'm sure you'll agree and celebrate, is that if, you know, in Colorado, Washington, you develop a marijuana problem, you need to go to rehab, I think maybe that's covered in Obamacare, Jim. And surely, if that's true, you will celebrate that with me. No?
I'm not a fan of Obamacare. I mean, I think the law has been implemented unbelievably badly. I think it'll be the gift that keeps on giving to Republicans through the 14 and 16 elections at least. However, we still face the problem, no matter, even if, you know, Ted Cruz gets elected president in 16, which I doubt will happen, and you repeal it, you still have the reality that since 1986, people have been guaranteed a primitive form of health insurance through the Emergency Treatment and Labor Act, signed by President Reagan, that I've never heard any Republican say that he or she wants to repeal.
What does that act say, actually? I wasn't aware of that as an act per se.
It says you can go to the emergency and get treatment.
That's a federal law?
A hospital with federal funding, which almost all of them have. And in addition, not only is there a federal law that says so, but it's the practical reality is that if you show up with a gunshot wound or a cocaine seizure in any hospital, the Hippocratic Oath will kick in, and more than likely they will treat you. And that doesn't happen all the time. There's certainly cases where they push on a bus and take you to say, hey, go to County General, not here. Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of hospitals that have shut down their emergency rooms, because, especially in Texas, where they can't deal with the illegal population and the swell of people coming from Mexico.
Can evade that law by just shutting down your emergency room?
Yeah.
That's kind of a loophole.
It is, but it's kind of a negative loophole for the rest of us, right?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, if you and I, being taxpaying yuppie citizens,
right, we would like an emergency room.
We would like the emergency room, right. And so, even if you go through the conservative literature on alternatives to Obamacare, you wind up, well, we'll have high risk pools. I mean, high risk pools, Medicaid. I don't think that repealing Obamacare, which, look, you can go through the 3,000 pages, that's really stupid, and any Republican should, and any Democrat should say, well, we should get rid of that. However, the basic point of a mandate, I'm sort of mystified as to why a mandate to buy health insurance is a bad idea. We have a mandate to pay for people's health. Why should, and again, as I just mentioned with EMTALA, we pay for people to have to get covered, in effect, so why shouldn't we make them pay? Again, I think the amounts of money are pretty small. I mean, it's bordering on symbolic in many cases, but anything that emerges post Obamacare will, I think, end up looking suspiciously like either Obamacare itself or Medicaid.
Well, do you think Obamacare is not going to survive the website fiasco?
It'll survive it. I think it will. I think the Democrats have dug, are going to dig in. I mean, they may well lose the Senate in 2014 over Obamacare and the backlash against it. They may well lose the White House. But there was a piece in the New York Times the other day, quoted a bunch of Republicans, including, you know, Senator Johnson of Wisconsin, saying, look, you know, the exchanges are kind of a good idea. We got to keep those. I think the Republicans have the luxury now of just sort of flamethrowing Obamacare, and it's been run horribly, and it's a permanent, dare I say, black spot on the president's record, and it just proves he's not a good president, not a competent executive, and the whole. But I think the left is saying, well, see, we told you we want a single payer all along, and this is a sort of growing pain on our way to UK NHS, which is what they've always wanted, and I think the Republicans it behooves them strongly to dream of something to do other than simply say, yes, we agree with you that we'll have to replace Obamacare, and then we'll have a showdown election in 16 or 20 where the battle is single-payer versus whatever else, some combination of Republican alternative plus status quo.
Isn't there the short-term problem for Obamacare that if, whether because of the website fiasco or for some other reason, but probably partly because of that, there are not enough of these younger, healthier people buying into the system, then the premiums for the rest of the people will be disturbingly high. Because after all, most of them aren't used to paying premiums that reflect a prohibition on excluding people for pre-existing conditions, which can be an expensive premium if you don't have all these younger people buying into the system. So isn't there, I mean, do you see that as one of the dangers that you think will make it ultimately a possibly damaging issue for Democrats?
I absolutely do. But I, on the other hand, I'm not exactly sure what the alternative is. I mean, it's whether or not young people have insurance policy, it's just paper. Okay. In other words, if somebody is old and sick and they're going to get covered, it's going to be charity. It's going to be Medicaid. It's going to be bankruptcy. The money's going to come. The hospitals eat it. Money's going to come from somewhere. We sort of live in an illusion that, well, the only way to make the pool viable is to get young people who don't need health insurance to get into the pool. That's one way. Another way is just simply to pay for it. We already are paying for it, is kind of my point. Yeah. And so I just sort of think it was kind of trickery, and the trick was really on Obama and the Democrats for saying, ah, yes, we need to put in this profoundly unpopular idea of a mandate on Starbucks workers to make this sort of fake accounting of the whole system match so that we can get it through the Senate and the House in 2009 and 2010, as opposed to simply saying, look, this is what healthcare costs for America, and we think everybody deserves this level of coverage, and we're going to pay for it one way or another, which is what's going to happen. It's sort of silly to have created this sort of incompetent, inept, idiocracy police state to make sure that somebody making $10,000 a year puts in $200 a year for insurance. It was sort of a Mickey Mouse, Rube Goldberg thing that frankly deserved to fail. Even as the basic commitment that we have to keep people from not only bleeding to death on the street after they have to have an accident, but also the public interest we share of not having people coughing on us with tuberculosis or, you know, whatever other kind of, you know, just reading somewhere about swine
flu. Meningitis where I live, buddy.
Meningitis, yeah, swine flu. And so 5 people have died in California for swine flu. I mean, there's a dense population, a densely packed population, of which most of America is, has extreme public incentive to prevent people from walking around with contagions.
Okay, so I guess when the Heritage Foundation thought up this plan, it was actually a long-term and clever scheme to plant it in the brains of liberals where it would blow up.
It does seem to have worked that way, didn't it?
Yeah. Could well. Now, I have a what would Jesus do question for you that's related to Obamacare, Jim. I'm serious. Last time I checked with you, you were taking the words of Jesus seriously. What would Jesus do if he were a Republican governor and the federal government said to him, as Obamacare says to them, look, we would like to expand the coverage for these people who are very, very close to the poverty line but don't right now have access to Medicaid, to basically free health care. There's not a huge, you know, we're not going to expand it hugely, but there's some of these people we can help in your state. We will pay for almost all of it, right? It's like 90% or something. You guys have to chip in almost a token amount to do quite a bit of good for these people who are very close to the poverty line. If Jesus were a Republican governor in one of these states, what would he say?
He'd say expand Medicaid, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
I shouldn't, just for the record here.
No. We're going to end the taping there. You just said that most Republican governors are not good Christians. The show is over. We're ending the taping. You're not allowed to elaborate. Sorry, Jim. See you next year.
I support Governor Kasich and Governor Brewer and
me too.
I've lost
track. They did the right thing.
I think they did the right thing. I should be more careful in saying, I'm not sure, who knows what Jesus is doing, but I suspect, I mean, Jesus always sort of struck me as kind of a social democrat, in his economics anyway. And so as along with the Pope, and so I would say to Republicans, I say to Americans, I say to even you, Bob, look, the real breakout of healthcare is not going to be some rejiggering of finance. It's going to be a transformation of the science. Okay. If we all wind up with Alzheimer's and it's a $200 billion hit on the economy now, headed towards $1 trillion a year by mid-century, it doesn't really matter very much whether it's Obamacare or Paul Ryan care or Bob Wright care as a financing scheme to deal with all these people, including, or you know, potentially you and me, sitting in a drooling in some dementia ward somewhere. And the same is true with diabetes and cancer and all sorts of things. The missing element in our politics when it comes to healthcare are the words research, medicine, and cures. Nobody talks like it. Interesting enough, I saw Richard Posner. You know, the judge in the Seventh Court of Appeals in Chicago, who's a very well known guy, prominent conservative, appointed by President Reagan, saying, "Look, if we don't tackle some of these issues," and when he mentioned Alzheimer's as a scientific problem, it's going to crush us financially. I think he had a good point. It was in this blog a couple of days ago. I think it was exactly right. That to me. You know, I'm with Peter Drucker. Don't solve problems, pursue opportunities. The healthcare, as long as healthcare is unbelievably complicated to consume, and 90% of it is paid for by third parties, which is the total for the U.S., then you show me a system nobody can understand, and somebody else is paying for it, and I guarantee, no matter who runs it, it's going to be complicated and a mess, and nobody's going to like it. Okay, and I by the same token, I don't think that you're going to achieve a massive reduction of that 90% figure to even 85% anytime soon. It's just too hard. By contrast, fixing things, solving problems, applying Moore's Law to medicine, hard as that is easy compared to changing human behavior.
Okay. Even if I accept all that, I would still like to briefly revisit this Republican governor point, because I've got to say, I do think of all the politically motivated acts we see all the time, this really is one of the most reprehensible, I've got to say, in my view. These Republican governors who are choosing not to cover these essentially poor people when it would cost their state almost nothing, and they're doing it to make a political point, and it's just a more vivid example than usual, I think, of what is the word, scum, I guess, so many politicians.
Well, I think Medicaid is so rife with fraud that I think you can make a
yeah, but that's not their actual concern.
I understand. I think it would be more useful to say, look, we agree on the goal.
Yeah.
Everybody gets covered. Now let's go after the ophthalmologists in South Florida and so on. I mean, and these Medicaid mills, there's stories all the time about, you know, people getting prescribed, you know, 200 pairs of eyeglasses and having spinal surgery, you know, over and over again. But that is a long-term challenging fight that I suspect would, if the ultimate accounting were done, I'd be easy to find that a third of Medicaid was total waste and fraud.
Oh, I'd be surprised if it's that high. But anyway, I've done my little sermon. What else is there to talk about? There is the partisan rancor, the lack of civility, and the general coming apart of America at the seams thing. Are you concerned about that?
Oh. Sure, but I think it's a function of the incompetence of the elites. I blame the elites.
Okay, elaborate on that.
I share with the average American a deep distrust of the competence of the people who gave us the Iraq War and the global warming crusade and Obamacare. The elites have to prove that they're worthy of our trust, and they're not proving that.
You mean the elites, like in Congress, or you mean elites more broadly?
Yeah, the opinion forming elites, some combination of the Congress plus the big media plus the foundations. I think they're done the country a deep disservice, and I don't think they're. I can't imagine putting my faith in them, and that doesn't mean. I mean, by the way, I think. my answer is we should have a better elite. My answer is we should have smart elites, not stupid elites, who focus on problems that we actually face and solve them. And I think I see a remarkable absence of that. And so in the meantime, I don't blame people for being angry.
Now, are you and I elites? And if so, are we good elites or bad elites?
Well, I think the question is, do you have a model in your head that would work to make the country better?
I do.
I think
everyone agreed with me.
I think actually, you know, look, Bob, you and I have agreed on probably more things than we've disagreed on over the years. Let's take away the things that I think the last 12 years in the Middle East has been a mistake. I think the effort to squelch the economy by stopping CO2 without thinking through alternative energy, and I don't mean solar, I mean nuclear or an adequate, satisfactory carbon sequestration plan. I think that's ludicrous in its inapplicability to the problems we face in the 21st century. If plants have been turning CO2 into a solid for billions of years, then why can't we figure out how to do it? And those are the kind of, instead we're having this sort of lame argument about cutting CO2 when the Chinese are cranking out more CO2 than we ever will, and the Russians and everybody else. And we're sitting here strangling our own industries. I was reading this book.
Are recently. We really, though? I mean, basically, how stringent are the actual domestic regulations on CO2?
I'll put it this way. The regulations are getting a lot more stringent. They basically wiped out coal, which they're happy to say they've done. They're delighted. They're proud of themselves for that. I'm influenced by a book by Paisano and Xi. They're professors at the Harvard Business School, and the book is something like Producing Prosperity. That's it, Harvard Business School, 2012. And it is unbelievably scary to read through how much industrial prowess this country, America, has lost relative to the world in the last 10 or 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And it's a combination of short-term accounting by corporations, trade policies, and I have to believe that if we're trying to compete with low wage labor, then it certainly behooves us to make, for example, electricity free. I mean, I don't mean low cost; I mean free. And there's no reason why the original idea of nuclear power, which is so cheap you didn't have to meter it, that to me still strikes me as a good idea in terms of encouraging people to make things that here in America, not only for our prosperity but also for our national defense.
Okay. What was I going to say about this whole energy issue? I mean, I agree that nuclear deserves a second look. I'm just not actually aware that and I haven't looked into it that much, that our regulations are so stifling or are costing us all that much money energy-wise.
We're not using our resources.
Yeah, I mean, but it seems to some extent what you're saying here and in the realm of healthcare is, why haven't we invented more? You know, why haven't we come up with the miracle solutions? And like, I don't know, we've had the free enterprise system working on it. I thought you were a champion of that. But I am
a champion of the free enterprise system, but I'm also a realist in knowing that the great inventions tend to come from nonprofits. Or monopolistic profits, Bell Labs, research institutions. They come from a national policy that says we need more of this. Okay, Alfred North Whitehead, the famous British mathematician and philosopher, said the greatest invention of the 19th century is the idea of the invention. Okay, as in, if you put people in a room and say, look, we need a chemical industry, we need a new weapon, we need a new cure for this, we need a new solution for that, you get it. I don't think for a second that Barack Obama has sat with his advisors and said, hey, we need some new breakthrough thing on this or this or this or this. I also don't particularly think John Boehner's done it either.
Lots of resources have gone into a cure for cancer and it hasn't happened. I mean, there's been some improvement in care, but
that's death rate for cancer has fallen by 60% in the last 40 years since Nixon's war on cancer. Now, that may not satisfy you, but it makes a big difference. Look, the number of people who died of prostate cancer has fallen by like 80%.
There's also a big over-treatment issue there.
But, okay, which do you worry more
about? I mean, a damaging over-treatment issue.
About being over-treated for prostate cancer or dying of prostate cancer?
Well, it depends on how many people you've got winding up sterile or impotent or whatever you wind up. The trade-off isn't, I wouldn't infinitely trade off, deaths for sterility and impotence.
If you're 70 years old, it might not be the end of the world to be sterile and impotent.
Speak for yourself, buddy. My aspirations, I'm already thinking about, I've already got my whole life planned out for the next 20, 30 years. And believe you me, I'm going to be having some fun.
I mean, look, I obviously we want maximum success and minimum failure. Okay, the death rate from heart disease has fallen by 3/4 since the 50s. Okay, we've been extremely triumphant in some areas. We've been lacking for any kind of national vision. This is why, again, back to the elites, of there is a technological solution to these medical problems that does not involve celebrating socialism or celebrating a quote good death unquote or natural this and homeopathic that and so on. It's just again, it's why the elites aren't really worthy of our.
No, I agree. I'm pretty disappointed in the elites. I mean, in the realm of foreign policy in particular. I mean, I thought the way America was thought to work 30, 40 years ago was that, like, you know, these guys from Wall Street were like orchestrating our foreign policy. That would be okay with me because I think, you know, I that would be an improvement, right? Because I think pure capitalists want a stable environment for capitalism to work in, right? They don't want to be. Unless they happen to be in the arms industry, they don't really want to be invading a lot of countries.
I worry a little bit when you say there were more lawyers from New York.
I don't want them in charge of economic policy. I want to emphasize that. Just foreign policy.
Yeah, but economic policy that just celebrates financialism and stock market bubbles is not an economic. It's not an economic strategy. Okay.
No, but I mean, no. I'm not talking about economics. I'm saying they would be anti-war. In theory, Wall Street should be anti-war. I just lament the days when American elites were thought at least to value world stability. The elites governing foreign policy were thought to value world stability, which means valuing peace.
I would say it emphasizes peace through strength. I mean, again, peace as a policy is not very good. Mm-hmm. Peace of strength as policy is good. I mean, and strategy. I mean, look, the elites that we retrospectively have come to admire, the people who led us through the Cold War to success, were tough minded. They made mistakes, which I would count Vietnam as one. I think you probably would too. Yep. But they had successes like the Strategic Defense Initiative, which was a huge success.
I wouldn't count that as a huge success.
Pardon?
What did we get out of that?
The victory in the Cold War.
Oh, give me a break. You know what gave us victory in the Cold War? The fact that communism doesn't work as an economic system.
No, I was told this by the former Russian ambassador to the United States, a guy named Luke, Lukhin, who said to a group at the Carnegie Endowment 20 years ago, said that when Reagan announced SDI in 83, then Soviet leader Andropov said, well, gee whiz, we got to study this. So they created two studies, one from the Soviet military and one from the Soviet Academy of Sciences. They came back 2 years later, and Andropov had died, Dzhokhar Chernenko had died too, and then now it's Gorbachev. And they said, listen, we don't know if the Americans can do this. This is a report now. This is Lukin talking. And I gave it to Paul Trigo in the Wall Street Journal at the time. But we know we can't.
Couldn't they? Because communism didn't work as an economic system. And if SDI hadn't focused them on that fact, other things were focusing them on the fact.
Gorbachev said, you're right, we need to reshape our system so that we can compete with this. And remember, Gorbachev's first idea as leader in Russia in the Soviet Union in 85 was not glasnost and perestroika. It was something called Uskorini, which meant acceleration. Just work harder. It was Stakhanovism. And that didn't work. And so then they stumbled their way through glasnost and perestroika, and in doing so, they pulled apart their own system. But as Lukin said, this is the quote, it's in the journal, I think it was probably 1991 now I think about it, said the Reagan's SDI, quote, accelerated the fall of the Soviet Union by 5 to 10 years, unquote.
That seems to me like high, but my main point is that, high at best, but my main point is that the outcome of the Cold War was inevitable as long as we didn't blow up the world in the meanwhile. Their system was failing. They had a billion incentives to finally reform it and try to move it in a more market-oriented way. What exactly got their attention? I don't know.
So you're not understanding somebody's first-person testimony?
No, it may have played a role. I'm just saying it was inevitable. What he was saying is what I said. They had an economic system that couldn't do anything. It couldn't produce elaborate technological things, but it also couldn't give the create a middle class. It was just. I was there while it was still the Soviet Union. It was a joke. The department stores. You go to the consumer electronics section. This is like in 1990, 91, and where we would have like TVs. You would look, and they would have like vacuum tubes to take home and fix your TV that doesn't work. You would buy the vacuum. You would go to where we would buy washing machines. They literally, this is the finest department store in Leningrad or St. Petersburg, whatever it was called at the time. They would have washboards. Washboards.
Bob, nations don't necessarily fall because their consumers are unhappy.
Well, okay, but whatever. They couldn't keep subsidizing all their client states. They just couldn't keep it together.
It was
armaments, everything. They couldn't do anything.
Look, I mean, we might even agree or disagree on this point, but in any case, the elite that came up with SDI, which I believe, and even you have to passively concede, has pushed the Soviet Union further towards collapse, will also come in handy if the North Koreans fire a missile at us, or the Chinese, or the Iranians, or the whoever's. And it's the kind of thing that a good elite would be working on, and a bad elite would say, oh, no, that'll have to come second to, some whatever stupid thing they're working on now.
No, I disagree, both because these systems in real life never wind up working the first time. You can test them all you want, but in the environment they're actually operating in, it's not going to stop a nuclear attack if there is one, A. And B, it just puts you in the wrong frame of mind. The right frame of mind to be in is we have to prevent. We have to create a situation where they're not going to launch.
How would you apply this Bob Wright logic to North Korea?
North Korea, it's just a question of waiting until it collapses and talking to China about it.
They're building nuclear weapons and rockets, and you just want to wait.
Well, I think we should be talking to China more about it. It's another incentive to work things out with China.
What if the Chinese are interested?
But look, North Korea is not going to launch a nuclear missile at the United States. If a North Korean nuclear bomb winds up going off in America, it'll be because they sold it to a terrorist who snuck it in.
So the fact that they're building A-bombs and rockets is not relevant.
I'm just saying that it's not going to hit us on a missile. If it does blow up in America, it will not have come into America on a missile.
What if it hits Japan?
North Korea is not going to attack.
Look, again, Bob, when things get built, they get used.
No, actually, Jim, we've built a jillion nuclear weapons, and since the first two, we've never used them. The Soviet Unions have never used any of theirs. The Chinese have never used any of theirs.
And nobody
thinks built all the time without getting used.
Nobody thinks that's the final status of nuclear weapons.
Well,
life is long. The world is long.
Right, but we have made some progress in the realm of nuclear nonproliferation, and as you know, global governance is a hobby horse of mine, and that could be a whole other discussion. But
global governance is fine for Kazakhstan. The Chinese understood.
Actually, I don't know that that's necessarily true.
I'm not interested in sharing.
Have they been super irresponsible in the UN Security Council?
No, Bob. They're just a different country. They have different interests. Okay, I'm not interested in being part of. I wouldn't want them governing us, and I wouldn't want just like they wouldn't want us governing them.
They want it into the World Trade Organization.
You know, Japan and India and all the rest of these.
They want it into the World Trade Organization. That's not global governance.
Sorry,
the World Trade Organization
is the way it's configured is helping them. It's free trade plus their currency devaluation. They're winning big in the current game. If the World Trade Organization cut against them, actually, they would change their mind.
Actually, the World Trade Organization allows everyone, including us, a way to kind of sublimate political pressure for tariffs and things by saying, wait, let's send this to the dispute mechanism of the WTO. Right. And I would say we all benefit from that.
So smart countries, of which we're not one, simply say, okay, fine, the WTO mandates this dope tariff thing, that's fine. So we'll think of non-tariff ways to do it.
They would be playing the same currency game, with or without the WTO, their currency policy would be essentially the same.
Well, but I'm saying then the WTO is worthless at a stated objective.
No, it's not worthless. It diffuses trade tensions so they don't turn into conflicts.
It's not reducing trade tensions when the Chinese are flooding our market and deindustrializing this country. It's weakening this country. 50,000 factories have closed in America in the last 20 years.
They're flooding the market with cheap labor.
Well, okay, but that's the way
everybody floods markets.
Well, yeah, right. It's not in our national interest not to have an autonomous industrial commons that can produce not only wealth but also. I mean, this is so much the history of this world of, to say, countries that, that had a conscious industrial policy, whether it was the United States or Germany in the 19th century or China, Japan and China in the 20th century, end up defeating countries that let themselves deindustrialize. And we're letting
Japan had a robust industrial policy 40 years ago, and look at Japan now.
Yeah,
its industrial policy get it in the long run? It had a couple of short term victories, and now it's a mess.
You can still make mistakes as they have, and understand that between Japan, South Korea, and China, they're doing something different than we are, and it's working better.
Yeah, some of them are failing. I don't know about that. I mean, China is clearly a rising power that has had tons of potential that has lain around unused, and it has finally figured out how to harness it, and it's not surprising.
And they're using cheap currency to sell us all their stuff and gain control of major markets in the United States, of important, not just plastic toys, but electronics and technology and all sorts of things. And not only will it make them rich, it will also engorge their military industrial companies. That's just the way of the world, Bob. And you can be a free trader and say, oh, that's nice. And, and one day you wind up and say, well, gee, how come they defeated us in a war? That's the real test of a policy, for not the prosperity of your country. It's whether or not you survive.
Right. But I thought you were saying our problem is prosperity.
No, what we discovered belatedly in the last few years is that the financialization leads to deindustrialization, also leads to impoverishment.
Yeah, no, I think we to some extent agree about Wall Street. It hasn't been productive. I'm not here to defend those policies at all. I mean, all I was saying was actually China has shown itself to be as willing as we are to participate in global governance. I don't know why you assume that they wouldn't be in the future.
On human rights?
Human rights is an exception, but we haven't really wanted to play that game either. We refuse to join the World Criminal Court.
No country wants to be governed by foreigners, period.
Well, no, that's not what global governance is, Jim. The WTO is an example of something that's not being governed by foreigners. It actually has real effect. It actually takes real trade disputes and keeps them from becoming major tariff wars. It has happened. And it's it can happen. But these are early days. I will say, and we get back, we started on my book, Non-Zero. What I said was either we will develop effective systems of global governance, or it may be very dark times indeed. And that's where you and I differ. You don't think that's where salvation lies, and I do. But I still don't understand where you think it does lie if your view is so apocalyptic and you don't think...
Where it lies is what I've always said, which is going to space. The world is getting smaller and more dangerous, and no...
Well, that's not salvation.
No, yeah, absolutely.
That's a life raft for 1% of humanity,
It could be a life raft for as many people as wanted. As long run, if we could get a space elevator going, for example, you could put lots of people up there. And you'd be draining away the most adventurous, obnoxious, cantankerous...
Well, there's definitely some people I want to send there.
Right. So, look, it's... You're not the reality of a big world, from a small world to the big population and lots of dangerous technology, is only going to get worse as time goes by. You're not going to settle it by papering over national tensions.
Why wouldn't the fundamentally human problems that threaten to blow up the world and that you want and are the reason you want some part of humanity to escape the world? Why wouldn't they reappear wherever humanity shows
they
up?
They would, but we'd be compartmentalized.
What you send? What different? What do you want to? How do you want to compartmentalize this? Different religions in different space capsules,
or the Earth blew up, we still have the Moon or Mars or Titan or
so just keep spreading and spreading and spreading and try to. It's like trying to run from a forest fire.
That's the story of the world. America is a happier place because we're not living in Europe or Africa.
Yeah, but we didn't escape. We are fundamentally and deeply engaged with Europe economically and otherwise. It wasn't like moving to another planet.
Escaped. We escaped. There's pilgrims escaped.
Not in the sense that you escape if you move to another planet, Jim, because we are economically intertwined with them.
Relative to things back then, they totally escaped. It was a 3-month trip, and it was that's what they did. They escaped. The people going to the Western frontier were escaping.
Europe didn't blow up. Europe's as nice a place to live as America.
But they didn't think so.
They were wrong.
Well,
because Europe turned out to be just about the same as America.
They wanted to get away from religious persecution and religious wars and everything else and kings and queens and create a new country. I applaud them for doing that. Just I applaud the Americans for rebelling against Britain, which wasn't a bad country, but still I'm glad we rebelled against them. In the long run, every place becomes confining and constricting. And if you don't have a long-term outlet for letting them go somewhere else, they will turn on themselves and turn on each other and kill each other. Okay. And so that's just so elemental as to how peoples flourish by expanding and getting away from old enemies.
Now, Jim, we've been doing this an hour, so we're going to have to call it to a close. I'm glad we've touched the fundamental Pinkerton basis here and wound up in outer space. But my question is, why don't you write this book? Your worldview is so distinctive. It really is. Do you know anybody else, really, who agrees with you on all this stuff? And if so, would you notify local authorities, please?
I'll get to it. You know, just,
I'm not kidding, man.
But maybe I'll just be a bunch of dialogue. Maybe I'll the book of the future won't be a book anyway. It'll just be dialogues with.
Writing is more efficient.
Little straight men.
Writing is more efficient to access than video, notwithstanding the Dingalink technology that we pioneered.
Damn.
Yeah. So, but anyway, Jim, thank you for another year of being Jim, something, as far as I know, only you can do. And I wish you and yours a happy new year.
Thanks, you too. Happy new year to you. Thanks for thinking of me. And thanks. Happy new year to all the Blogging Head fans out there.
Ditto. All right. Take care.
Okay. Thanks, Bob. All right.
See ya.